Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon. And the purpose of having a live broadcast is that it might be interactive in real time between the host and the listeners. If you are listening right now, that's the only way you'll know I'm speaking to you, as if you are, then you are a listener and you are qualified, therefore, to be part of the program. Now, we do have a certain format, and that is that you would call the program if you have a question about the Bible or the Christian faith or the Christian life that you'd like to discuss. And it's also possible for you to call if you have a difference of opinion from the host and want to discuss that. We welcome calls in any case for these things. And there's a phone number you'll need. Let me give it to you. And we have one line open right now. Some of our lines are already occupied. But the number is 844-484-5737. Again, it's 844-484-5737. And we welcome your calls. In this coming hour, if you call and get a busy signal, then it'll just be a matter of time before these lines clear, because these callers don't stay here forever. We talk to them, they move along, and a line opens for you. So keep that number on hand, even if you get a busy signal. The number 844-484-5737. Dan from Detroit, Michigan, our first caller today. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Dan. Thank you for calling.
Hi, yeah. I'm calling. I talked to you a couple months ago about a relationship that I was in, and the reason I'm calling back is just some advice on something. I've been trying to restore my relationship with Christ, and I've been living with my girlfriend for about 6 years. And, you know, I've recently repented, and we're still living together, and I know she wants to get married. Anyways, to make a long story short, I started attending a church that the pastor brought to my attention why we're not married, and it pretty much came down to, I understand being unequally yoked and all that, but he was explaining to me, we've been together this long, and he would normally say don't marry her, but in this case he was pretty much telling me to ask her, you know, let her know Jesus is going to be number one in my life, and if she's okay with that, go ahead and marry her. And I'm, you know, of course that's what I want to do, because I've been with this woman for 6 years and we've had some problems in the past, but I'm kind of curious on your advice about that.
Yeah. Well, if she and you are otherwise free to marry one another, that is to say, if you don't have any wrongful divorces or ex-spouses that you have some obligations to, then there is that other issue of her not being a Christian. I do not recommend that a person marry a non-Christian if that person himself is trying to follow God. It can be very difficult. Now, here's what I would suggest is she must certainly have been told that you want to follow Jesus Christ. Her reaction is either going to be somewhat agreeable or somewhat resistant. If it is resistant, then you're going to have a problem if you marry her, because she's already exhibiting resistance to Christ. Now, if she's not resistant, what is there that prevents her from becoming a Christian too?
Are you asking me? Is that?
Yes.
Uh-huh. I guess she's, I mean, she believes in God, but, you know, I've done everything I could as far as in trying to get her to go to church with me and this, and she's one of those people that it's just can't believe that there's only one way type of thing, no matter, you know, what I do. And
that's, is she willing that's to look into it? Is she willing to look into it?
I mean, I don't know how much more I could do. I mean, I've tried to show her clips that print out of as many things as I could find for her. And it's just, she has this kind of mindset of just, you know, if you're a good person type of thing. And I understand it's not the right way. I guess the problem I'm facing here is, since we've, you know, been together for 6 years, and now it's, I understand if I was single and I'm coming here and I'm saying, you know, obviously don't go and look for a non-Christian, but the fact of the matter is I realize I made a mistake in thinking I could save someone. And now,
well, Dan, let me ask you this. How old are you and she?
I'm 30. She's 31.
Was she, were you the first guy she was with?
No. She was the first one that I was with, though.
So. Yeah. If you were the, if she had been a virgin when you first slept with her, there would actually be something in the law that would place some obligation upon you to marry her. But that's not necessarily the case. Well, I'll tell you this. You know, if you follow your pastor's advice and go ahead and marry her, I'm not gonna you know, inveigh against you. But I would say this, that even if she were a Christian and you as a Christian wanted to follow Christ wholeheartedly and she was somewhat reluctant to be sold out for Christ, but she was a professing Christian, I would still warn you against marrying her for the simple reason that a man who wants to go wholeheartedly for Christ, that's going to affect the way he conducts his finances. If children come into the marriage, it's going to have a lot to do with how the children are going to be raised.
Right.
Lifestyle choices, you know, satisfaction with a certain standard of living and things like that are all going to be possibly problems between two people, one of whom is totally devoted to the kingdom of God and the other simply isn't. Whether that other person is calling themselves a Christian or not, the fact that she doesn't call herself a Christian and won't and, you know, is resists, you know, believing.
When it talks about the Bible, when he's giving instruction about, you know, you're married to an unbeliever and you were both he's trying to treat it like, I guess, what's that verse in the Bible that it talks about? If one's a Christian and the other one's not, and they're willing to live with you, you know, I understand that for a married couple, but he's...
It is, yeah. I mean, the difference is that when you're shacked up with somebody for a number of years, you're still not really married to them unless there has been some kind of agreement between the two of you that we're married. I mean, if you would go to a prostitute on the same street corner 3 times a week for 6 years, and I'm not saying your girlfriend's a prostitute. That's not what I'm saying. This is just trying to make something clear. If you sleep with a prostitute 3 times a week over a period of years, that doesn't make her your wife.
Right.
What makes a woman your wife is that the two of you have entered into, by mutual agreement, a lifelong covenanted agreement. Now, short of that, let us say for the moment that you had gone 3 days a week to a prostitute on the street corner for 6 years or 10 years or whatever, and then you decide to become a very strong Christian. Well, you'd simply stop going to that prostitute. Now, the truth is, in the case of this woman, she's not a prostitute. She's somebody that you presumably love. And therefore, I don't mean to, you know, introduce any insult by the analogy. The point I'm trying to make is sleeping with somebody over a period of time without any commitment to be married to them doesn't translate into a marriage.
In my heart, I already, because this was the, you know, first woman I've ever been with, and in the beginning, that was my intent that, you know, maybe she would be my wife and so forth. And because we shared that, I obviously became bonded to it personally, and I'm trying to make it
may be
work.
True.
And I understand your analogy, but it's so hard for me to just think of it in that way. I mean,
and I understand why that's hard for you. I do understand that. I'll tell you what my counsel would be, and then you'll have my counsel, and you'll have your pastor's counsel, which is somewhat different, and you'll be able to just kind of take the two and weigh them and go the way that you think best. All right. I would suggest that since you want to follow Jesus Christ, you tell your girlfriend that living together unmarried, of course, is not acceptable, and marrying a non-Christian, unfortunately, is not acceptable either, although you still love her and would still like to be her husband. But Jesus Christ is going to be the most important factor in your life from this point on, which includes your, you know, expenditure of money, the way you would raise kids, and all the important things that are issues of compatibility between a man and a wife. And so I would suggest, you know, I really hope that you might also come to know the Lord, and it's certainly would be the best for you, I believe, but it also would make it possible for us to consider, you know, spending our lives together. Until then, I'm going to move out over into this other place. But I, since I love you, I'm not going to pursue another relationship at this point. I'm going to cancel out what was wrong in our relationship.
So I can't feel like, since we've been together for that many years, I owe it to her to marry her, or feel like I've wasted her time, or...
Well, you haven't wasted her time just yourself. She has too. I mean, when two people do not marry but give themselves sexually to each other, you know, if it turns out that the relationship does not stay together, well, that's the risk you take by not being committed to each other. You know, I mean, if you're committed to each other for life, that's when you get married. If you're not getting married, it's because you're not really ready to take that step. And a person who doesn't take that step and isn't committed for life can hardly complain if the relationship doesn't last for a lifetime. It was never committed for a lifetime. But it can be. I mean, that's the point. I mean, since I think this is how you feel, I would say, listen, it's nothing, and nothing about us and our relationship, you know, that I'm dissatisfied with. And it's not even that I wouldn't spend my whole life with you. I would. But as a Christian, I know I have to follow Jesus Christ. And if you want to follow Jesus Christ, we can do that together. You know, if you don't want to follow Jesus Christ, then I hardly see how I can be on a horse riding north and you're on a horse riding south, because we are on different paths. You know, if I'm following Jesus, I'm on a path. And if you're following something other than Jesus, that's a different path. And I don't know how we can be married and ride two horses going separate directions.
So it's the years of us being together, that's just something I have to get over then and not feel guilty about it, because I feel a tremendous amount of guilt for some reason about that.
Well, no, you should feel, I mean, you should resolve any feelings of guilt you may have over your involvement in fornication. But I presume you've already repented of that,
right?
and you're fine before God about that. She has the same issue personally to handle. She's been in a relationship of fornication too. You're not guilty of her fornication. You're guilty of your fornication. She's guilty of hers. So if she says, okay, I let myself get bonded sexually and emotionally with this man, but I don't want to follow his God, well, then that's just one of the really hard things that happens to people when they take separate courses. And when they get involved with each other without having that basis of marriage as the bond. If she and you had gotten married back then, or at any time since then, and then you became a Christian, then I would agree with your pastor. I would say, well, you're a Christian. Now she's not. You're going to have a hard time because she doesn't want to follow Jesus, and you do, but you're stuck, right?
I'm not saying I would do this, but... What if I did go ahead and marry her? What would happen at that point?
I mean, just be buying yourself some problems. I think it would be an act of disobedience, though I don't know how, you know, I don't know how, you know, since God would have a man and woman stay together unequally yoked if they were already married, it must not be that God is absolutely intolerant of Christians and non-Christians living under the same roof as husband and wife, if they already have that commitment. He warns against entering into such a commitment, and I think it would be a mistake. But again, you're going to have to sort that out. You've got a pastor telling you something different, and he may, you know, maybe he has the mind of God, and I don't. I don't claim that my advice is, you know, infallible. But
I guess if I did marry her, is that like an unforgivable sin of some sort? That's what I feel.
No. It's not unforgivable sin. Now, if you married a non-believer and later, you know, in the hopes that she's going to be a believer someday, and if she never becomes a believer, you're going to live with the hardships of, you know, trying to follow Christ with a partner who doesn't want to. Are you or she interested in having children?
Possibly. I mean, it didn't seem like she was very interested. I was, but at this point, I haven't even really thought about it, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that would cause problems. And I told her that. I'm like, you know, if we got married, I'd be going to church. I'd want to bring our kid up in the faith. And she agreed to that, but that doesn't mean anything. You know, when the time comes, I realize
People agree to a lot of things, yeah. Well, let me just tell you, I've been in hard marriages before, but I've never married a non-Christian. Or at least I've never knowingly done so. I've been in more than one marriage that was difficult, and difficult, but I wouldn't leave because I don't believe in divorce. So I was pretty much, as it were, stuck in marriages that, although the women I married, and there have been two cases who eventually left, they professed to be Christians. And they seemed to be Christians. Not just they didn't just verbalize it. They were living the Christian life before I knew them, and when I knew them. So I mean, I thought I was getting married to a believer. I certainly didn't see myself as becoming unequally yoked. But it became extremely difficult when they, both of them, decided that following Jesus was not really going to be what they want to do. But I couldn't leave. I mean, as I understood it, I could not. Once when they left and divorced, I figured, well, that's Christ's. I mean, that's Paul's. You know, the subject matter in 1 Corinthians 7.
Is it a sin for me to marry her? I understand it's a warning, but if I go ahead and marry her, does that, I just committed a sin right there? That's what I can't figure out. I understand unequally.
Well, it depends. Yeah, it depends on whether Paul's comments about that are intended to be advice or commands. It's actually the case that we're in a place where Paul says a widow can marry anyone she wants to, but only in the Lord. That's in 1 Corinthians 7.
Right.
In that whole chapter, Paul says quite a few times, I don't have a command from God about this or that. But he says, I say this not by way of commandment, but to spare you. I think a lot of Paul's advice about marriage is to spare us. So that would depend on whether his statement about not being unequally yoked would be taken as a command or as just good counsel with reference to the situation.
So we really don't know that then as far as...
Well, I would take it, if I were in your position, I would take it as a command. Okay, that's how I would understand it. But I'm not a legalist. I mean, there is a possibility that Paul sometimes is giving good advice, but you know, you're free to make your mistakes and live with the consequences. What I'm saying is, if you think about compatibility issues, you guys apparently have been fairly compatible for 6 years living together, but you haven't been joined. Does she have an income?
A little bit, not that much.
Okay, so are you her complete support?
Just about.
Okay. Now, the reason I ask this is because if you're sharing, you know, a single income, as I think is ideal, to tell you the truth, in a marriage, but that's not always the case. But if you're sharing a single income and she's got no problem with you being the complete steward of how you spend the money that comes in, as long as you're providing housing and food and the necessities, if she doesn't mind that you give a lot of it to God, you give a lot of it to missions or to the poor, and that you live modestly, which is something you will feel convicted to do if you don't already, if you follow Jesus Christ. She won't have the same convictions because she doesn't have any reason to. She's not a Christian. So, I mean, a woman can become very, very resentful toward her husband if she would like to have something that she thinks they can afford, and he's given his money off to missionaries or something like that. I mean, that's just one example. The same thing with kids. You know, if he's raising kids to be Christians and the kids come home from Sunday school and they say, Mommy, you know, are you going to hell because you're not a Christian? I mean, she's not going to feel very good about that. I mean, you've got to use some real sense when you enter into any marriage. And like I said, even a Christian marrying another Christian is foolish to marry someone who does not share his values on the major issues about which marriages often break up. Marriages break up often over these very issues. And, I mean, if this woman were extremely compliant, I think, you know, I think a woman who's very compliant in by nature, who doesn't mind her husband being a Christian, though she hasn't been converted, she might well and easily be converted by, you know, the influence of her husband. But if you've been trying to persuade her and she's resistant, then she's not the woman I just described. She's a woman who's resistant. That doesn't mean her resistance will never end and that she'll never become a Christian. I can't predict that. It could. Right. It's just that you have no guarantees that it will. And I think anyone who gets married to somebody who's not compatible on the most essential issues of life It's just asking for usually hell on earth, frankly. Marriage could be heaven on earth, or it could be hell on earth, depending on how compatible the parties are, especially with reference to their commitment to God. Dan, I've got my lines full. We've been talking for half the program almost.
All right, Steve. I appreciate it.
Okay. I'd like to give you advice that's easier to take.
I appreciate it.
All right. God bless you, Dan.
Thanks, Steve.
Bye. All right. Bye now. All right. Let's talk to Daryl from Sacramento, California. Daryl, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
How you doing?
Thanks for waiting.
I called you the other day about some giving some advice on some study material. Mm-hmm. And I understood that your knowledge came through studying yourself, because I used to be in the Word of Faith, and it was through sitting up late at night just studying my Bible that I realized that doctrine was bad, you know?
Right.
But I heard other things preached and mentioned that I didn't see directly in the Bible, so I started looking for other study tools. By you being a person who believes in the gifts of the Spirit, I hadn't heard a radio show like yours before. Uh-huh. So I said, well, let me see what type of commentaries you use. You recommended one, and I didn't get the name of it because I couldn't. I guess when you start talking, you couldn't hear me. You said Gordon something, and I didn't hear the end of it.
Well, Gordon Fee, F-E-E, is a Pentecostal commentator. And he wrote, for example, a major commentary on 1 Corinthians. But he hasn't written, to my knowledge, he hasn't written a commentary on the whole Bible. So it's not as if, you know, you want to find a good Pentecostal commentator writing on 1 Samuel or on Jeremiah or something like that. I don't know.
No, I just wanted, you being a teacher, I just wanted your best open mind, who you would enjoy the best as far as being open minded. One of them you mentioned was F.F. Booth. I have some of his.
He's great.
He is open-minded because it doesn't sound like he believes in the gifts of the Spirit. Well, it doesn't sound like he speaks in tongues, but yet he doesn't deny. He said he sees no reason why that gift should cease. I like that thought.
Yeah, yeah. F.F. Bruce is a very open-minded man, though was. He's gone on to be with the Lord now. But, I would have disagreed with him on some of his theology, but he was very seldom pushing any kind of theology I disagreed with, you know. And he's very responsible. Did I mention the Tyndale commentaries? I think I probably did.
I believe you did, yeah.
Yeah, those, you know, I don't recommend commentaries very often, but the ones I mentioned to you are ones that I sometimes feel good about recommending. I have to say that, you know, I've read lots of commentaries, including a lot of them by people I don't agree with.
And what about other study tools that you think or believe you're trying to study would need, like dictionaries or things like that?
Well, to
I
my
heard
mind,
about Wiest's word study. I heard it was very good.
Wiest is okay, yeah. I mean, Wiest's word studies are okay, and so is Vine's, expository dictionary of Bible words. Those are especially Vine's is a very useful book. You're going to want to, you probably have a Strong's Concordance.
Yeah.
Do you have a Strong's Concordance? Okay. Every Christian should have a Strong's Concordance, a Bible and a Strong Concordance if there's nothing else on their shelf, because the Strong's Concordance will give them access to everything in the Bible. Every time a particular word is used or whatever, you can find it in Strong's Concordance. And there's also the Greek and Hebrew dictionaries in the back, which, I mean, it's a very useful reference. It's not the deepest. The dictionaries in the back don't go as deeply into the meaning of Hebrew and Greek words as, say, a lexicon would, or even as something like Wiest or Vine's would. But, you know, most of the books that I use the most are very generic. They're not theology specific. For example, Vine's dictionary. Vine was a Plymouth Brethren, as was F.F. Bruce. They were both part of the Plymouth Brethren. Now, Vine's was a dispensationalist and a Calvinist. I don't agree with either dispensationalism or Calvinism, but he still, for the most part, is a good source on the meaning of Greek words. Although sometimes his own theology will come in, and you can kind of tell when it does.
Yeah.
But most of the time, not. Most of the time, and you know, F.F. Bruce was in the Plymouth Brethren, and he was a Calvinist, though he didn't push that very strongly. And he was not dispensational. He was more amillennial. But in any case, I would say look for honest commentators. And so much of what they say is going to be things that all Christians would agree about. That's the thing. I mean, the specific theology of a commentator isn't that big a deal in most cases. With most
pastors, the thing I'm looking for more of the deeper stuff or the more history. I listen to some of your teachings. I get online. You go more into just what your average sermon hears or teaches. Because a lot of the saints, they don't study their Bible, so you don't get to conversate with anybody.
I know.
Read beyond
verse. My studies do go deeper than most sermons because I'm a Bible teacher, and many pastors are really more sermon makers and sermon deliverers, presenters. But actually, you know, in some cases, probably my lectures go deeper than you're going to find in any one commentary, because I've not only accessed the commentaries, but I've also done a lot of study and thinking of the Bible on my own. And frankly, I'm not satisfied with shallow answers. So I tend to keep digging until I find something that's solid as a rock in there.
Now, I see what you have where you can download that, but is that in any type of written form?
No, my lectures are not in written form for the most part. I mean, some of them have been transcribed, but they're not posted or anything like that. Individuals have contacted me and let me know they were transcribing this lecture or that lecture. And sometimes they'll send it to me, a file of it, but I haven't posted them. That'd be a huge amount of, a single lecture would be 30 pages of transcribed text.
Right, so you have a lot in there, yeah.
There's 900 lectures there, yeah. I mean, that'd be 300 pages each or something. I don't know, but that's a lot.
Okay, I got you on that. And the other thing I had was that I heard you say, if I heard you say it right, was that the apostle, the gift of being an apostle, ceased with the apostles. Did I hear you correct on that?
Well, I didn't say that, but I suspect that it may be true. I don't have a firm position on that. I would say that it's entirely possible that the apostolic gift, which was a foundation in the church in the first century, may not need to be repeated every generation, because Paul said that the church is built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets. Well, the foundation of the church was laid 2,000 years ago, and others have built on it since then. So it may well be that apostles were only needed at that time.
To say that gift has ceased, and then to believe in tongues, it doesn't match up. I mean, it seems like the gift would cease when we come into the fullness of the body of Christ, which I don't think no man can determine when that's going to be.
Well, an apostle is not the same kind of gift as a gift of tongues. An apostle is more like an office. Speaking in tongues would be an ability that people have.
I know,
it's like prophecy. A prophet is an office, but prophesying is an activity or an ability. And I believe that all the gifts and abilities that were given to the early church may be available to the church today as well, but not necessarily all the offices. For example, the office of Messiah has not been replaced. We've still got the same Messiah as the early church had, and the 12 apostles he chose, they have not been replaced, as near as I can tell. The church is built with Christ as the cornerstone and the apostles as the foundation and so forth. So in other words, those are offices which may or may not require, succession and replacement of the participants in them. I think possibly not. I'm not.
What do you think about Ephesians 4:13 then, where it says, until we come in to the fullness of the body of Christ? It lists these gifts and didn't say they were given to the church until. What do you think that verse would mean?
Well, he gave some apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers for the, equipping of the saints for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, until we all come in the unity of the faith and the knowledge of the Son of God unto a mature man. That's what these gifts were given for, is for the church to reach maturity. Now, to say that Christ gave all these gifts does not mean necessarily that there have to be people occupying those offices the whole time. For example, I still benefit from the apostles, the 12, and Paul too. In other words, God gave the apostles to the church. We don't know that there will be new apostles every generation, but the apostles that he gave us are there to equip us until the church comes to maturity. We won't need any more, I guess, apostolic authority anymore after church comes to its maturity when Christ comes. But until then, the ministry of the apostles is benefiting the church, likewise the prophets. Now, whether there are living apostles and living prophets would be another question, because the apostles who wrote the New Testament and the prophets who wrote the Old Testament, their witness continues with us. We still have it in the Bible.
There were men called apostles that besides the 12, though, or in the
yes,
Bible.
There were.
Right?
Yes, there were, but most of them didn't write any scripture, and we don't have their witness anymore.
Yeah, but the gift existed, though.
Well, there were people who were sent. That's what the word apostle means. The apostles are ones who are sent. And some of the apostles describe themselves as apostles of Jesus Christ, like Paul and Peter are apostles of Jesus Christ, which means Jesus Christ sent them. They are sent ones from Jesus. There are others.
You mentioned two different offices. You're saying some apostles sent directly by the Lord. Other apostles have that title in the Bible.
Well, yes, because Paul mentions in the 8th chapter of 2 Corinthians that his companions in ministry were also apostles of the churches. He didn't call them apostles of Jesus Christ as if Jesus had sent them, but they were apostles of the churches, sent by the churches. So, Timothy and Titus and perhaps Silas and maybe even Barnabas might be regarded as those who were apostles of the churches. They were sent out by the churches, but Jesus didn't himself personally, appear to them and say,
I understand you. I just want to say one thing, and I'm going to get off the phone. The brother who just called, and he asked about being unequally yoked together. I've been married for about 30 years. My wife is she goes to church with me, but she doesn't. We are being unequally yoked together still, and it's very difficult at times, especially me being ahead, me being one to lead the family, to set goals, to accomplish goals. On a New Year's, for instance, I may want to go to church. You want to go to the club. It's very difficult. I would advise anybody, if they can avoid being unequally yoked together, do not do it, because you have a passion, you want to do the work of God. The other person has a passion for themselves, and they're going to want that spouse to please them when you want to please the Lord. It's going to be very difficult.
I would advise nobody
to do it. I can't get before comfortable guy like you said, but I'm living it.
All right. Well, your testimony is valuable. I appreciate you sharing it, Daryl.
Hey, thanks a lot.
All right. God bless you. Bye now. All right, let's talk to Mike from Woodinville, Washington. Mike, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
The blessing Lord's put on you for your ministry.
We'll try to use it.
My question is, in the book of Ezekiel, I'm doing a chronological read, and the Lord refers to Ezekiel 90-some-odd times as the
Son of Man
when he's addressing Ezekiel. Can you put any clarity on that for me?
Maybe, but it shouldn't be confused necessarily with Christ, who called himself the Son of Man about 70
right.
times.
Right, I understand that.
Right. But the term Son of Man is a term used frequently in the Bible, not usually to address an individual, as in the case of Ezekiel. As far as I know, only two individuals in the Old Testament are addressed as Son of Man. Daniel is.
Okay.
I think it's in chapter 11 or 12 of Daniel. An angel speaks to Daniel as Son of Man.
Okay.
But I think only once in Daniel. But you're right, about 90 times in Ezekiel, he is addressed as Son of Man. Now, in most of the occurrences outside of Ezekiel, most of the Old Testament occurrences of the term Son of Man, it is used in the Psalms and in, frankly, throughout the Old Testament, to simply mean a man, a human, a son of man is a Hebrew expression that means a human. And many times it means the emphasis on it is a mere human. In other words, it's not just identifying the person as a human being, but as an emphasis on the fact you're a mere human being. You're a mere son of Adam.
Possibly God is just referencing Ezekiel, even though he's as a prophet, he's just referencing Ezekiel as, even though you are my prophet, you are still just a mere man.
Yes, I think so. And the reason I think so is because Ezekiel received amazing revelations and visions, such as very few prophets and men of God have had. And remember when Paul was talking about his own visions that he had had, Paul had had, in 2 Corinthians 12, he says, because of the, you know, abundance of the revelations, I was given a thorn in the flesh, you know, to keep me from being exalted above measure. Paul indicates that there's a temptation when you've received startling and unusual visions from God to start thinking of yourself as something special. And in order for Paul not to think too much of himself, God gave him what he referred to as a thorn in his flesh.
Right.
I think it may be that in continually referring to Ezekiel as son of man, son of man, son of man, God was trying to keep Ezekiel more or less in his proper place. I mean, he was giving him lots of revelations. He could certainly feel superior to other, you know, religious people in his community because he and not they were receiving all these revelations from God. But
okay.
it's very possible that the term son of man was used to speak to him only to emphasize that you are still a mere man. You might be caught up into the spiritual realm and see things that other people can't see, but you're just human, you know.
Right.
Now, by the way, in other parts of the Bible, the word son of man in the poetry of the Old Testament often is simply used in parallel with the word man.
Mm-hmm.
Hebrew poetry is characterized by saying the same thing twice or three times or more. In other words, repetition, couplets in the Psalms, in the Proverbs, and in Job, and in frankly, in the prophets, too, which are written in poetry. One of the most common features of Hebrew poetry is repetition of the same idea in two successive lines. And so it's very common to find the word son of man used in that kind of poetry parallel with man. For example, in Psalm 8, where it says, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you visit him? It's the same statement twice.
Right.
It's just that the first time it refers to man and the second time the son of man. But they're both, they mean the same thing. A son of man is almost even more diminutive than the word man. You know, a man's son in that society would have slightly less dignity than the father. The father is the superior to the son. And that's why Jesus said, well, if the Messiah is David's son, why would David call him his Lord? You don't call your son Lord. The son calls his dad Lord, maybe. But so in saying, what is man? That's in itself, you know, bringing man down a few notches. What is man that God would be mindful of him? And then, or the son of man would even take it down a notch further. You know, I'm not just a man. I'm the son of a man. There's in the Hebrew usage of these terms, there would be nuances that we might miss unless we become very familiar with them. Of course, if you read the Old Testament a lot, you will become very familiar with them because there's so much of the Old Testament written in poetry and the term son of man very commonly.
So much so. That adds a lot of clarity, and that helps a lot. And one more quick one, if I could, in Ezekiel, I'm somewhere in chapter 34, 35, but they're talking about the vision of the bronze man, which I kind of take as Messiah or possibly the Lord speaking with Ezekiel, and he's giving the measurements of the new temple that will be built in the millennium.
That'd actually be chapter 40.
40?
Okay, yeah.
I didn't realize I was that far. Woo!
Yeah.
And then it goes on to they go back into the sacrificial way of doing things again, and I mean, are we not supposed to have gone away from that with the sacrifice of the lamb, sacrifice of Christ? And but yet he goes on to talk about, you know, killing the calves and the rams and bringing the offerings to the altar.
I understand the problem completely. First of all, let me just say that in saying that this temple will be built in the millennium, you probably are depending on some pastor or teacher or a study Bible that identifies it as a millennial temple in the future.
That is not correct.
Yeah, that is not the only way to understand this, and it's not the way I personally understand it, but it's very common among dispensationalists especially, and many study Bibles are written by dispensationalists, to say that chapters 40 through 48 of Ezekiel, the last nine chapters, are describing a millennial temple that will be built after Jesus returns.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the problems you've identified is a very good one to note. in the description that Ezekiel gives, you've got animal sacrifices, you've got a, you've got priests, you've got Levites, you've got all the same old stuff from the Mosaic
right.
order. And yet the book of Hebrews is very adamant that those things are done and gone, and
right.
Jesus is sacrificed once and for all. There's no more sacrifices, no more earthly temple, no more Levites, because there's now a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, and there's a, been a change of the priesthood, and that change of the priesthood is permanent. It's forever. So, in other words, how do we reconcile the idea that this temple in Ezekiel 40 through 49 seems to be you know, following the Jewish order of worship, which has been abolished in the New Covenant, if indeed it is a future temple that will be built in the millennium? Now, what the dispensationalist usually says in answer to that is that the sacrifices in this temple are not meant to be atoning sacrifices, but actually they are meant to be memorial sacrifices as a memorial to what Christ has done. So that
really?
As the Old Testament saints offered sacrifices which anticipated the sacrifice of Christ, in the millennium they will offer sacrifices that are reminiscent of the sacrifice of Christ. But this is problematic too, because the passage, if you read the whole section, it actually says that they are offering sacrifices as an atonement. So that particular excuse doesn't work. I actually wrote a whole article on Ezekiel's temple for the Christian Research Journal. It came out a few issues ago. I forget which issue had it, but they might have it posted at their they might have it posted at their website at CRI. Equip.org, I think.
Uh-huh.
Now, anyway, my understanding is this. This is not a millennial temple. This is not a future temple at all. When Ezekiel wrote this and had this vision, he and the Jews were gone from Jerusalem. They were in Babylon in captivity.
Right.
The temple that Solomon had built was gone. It was destroyed by the Babylonians. There was no temple. However, God had promised that there would be a temple again, that God would restore his people from captivity. They would restore Jerusalem, and they'd restore the temple. In my opinion, what Ezekiel gives is the revelation God gave him of what the temple could be when it is restored. However, it is conditional. In Ezekiel 43, it's in verse 10 and 11. God says to Ezekiel, "Son of man, describe the temple and the house to the house of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure the pattern. And if they are ashamed of all that they have done, make known the temple design and so forth to them." Now,
very true. I think I read that this morning.
Okay, and that's Ezekiel 43, 10 and 11, which seems to make it conditional. This is the temple that they might have someday if they are ashamed, if they have repented of all that they've done. Well, did they? I think not. I think they didn't. And when they were given the opportunity to go back to from Babylon to Jerusalem, very few of the Jews wanted to. Only 50,000 out of millions went back. So in a sense, they weren't that ashamed. They weren't that zealous for God and for restoring things. They weren't repentant. And therefore, they didn't get this temple after all. They got another. They got a temple, but it was much smaller, much less elaborate, much lower budget. But this was the plan that God gave them while they were in Babylon to encourage them that, you know, they could have this great, glorious temple again, like they had when Solomon's temple was standing. And by the way, this one is very similar to Solomon's temple that's described here. But it's not similar to any temple they've had since then.
Oh.
And so, you know, this it would seem to me that since the millennium can't really have animal sacrifices in it, no future worship of God can involve animal sacrifices in my understanding of the New Testament. Therefore, it's not a future temple at all. It's actually a temple that would have been if Israel had repented thoroughly.
Wow. Oh.
All right.
That's awesome. That's awesome insight. Thank you so much, Steve.
Okay, Mike, thanks for calling.
Have a great day.
God bless you. You too. You have a great day too. Joshua from Salinas, California is next. And let me just say before I take this call that I'll be in Salinas day after tomorrow. I'll be holding a question and answer time in Salinas, California. And that's going to be at the St. Paul's Episcopal Church. Now, this is not sponsored by the St. Paul's Episcopal Church, a, a listener in Salinas acquires this room in this church once in a while, whenever I come up that way, and you're all welcome to join us. It's on Pajaro Street in Salinas. That'll be Friday night at 7:30. All right? Just a question-answer period in Salinas. If you're in or near Salinas this Friday, day after tomorrow, 7:30 p.m. at the St. Paul's Episcopal Church, we'd love to see you. But the next night, this Saturday, I'll be in Santa Cruz, and I'm going to be giving a lecture on the subject of demon possession. Now, if you've ever heard a teaching about demon possession, there's a good chance you heard it from someone who's in a deliverance ministry. I am not. I'm not a deliverance minister. I'm not someone who's looking for demons under every bush. I'm not somebody who's going to see you cracking your knuckles and say, oh, that's a demon, let's get that out of there. I'm not that kind of a teacher. I'm not that kind of a minister. But I am a Bible teacher, and I am concerned that many Christians are very ignorant about this reality of demon possession. I think we encounter it sometimes and don't even recognize it. And if we do recognize it, we often don't know what to do about it. So let me encourage you this Saturday night, if you're in the Santa Cruz area, to join us at the Christian Life Center. Again, they are not sponsoring this talk. They're just renting us the facilities. The Christian Life Center on Mission Street in Santa Cruz, that'll be at 6:30 this Saturday night. And we welcome all of you in the Santa Cruz area to join us there. This Saturday night, I'll be talking about demon possession, a very thorough examination of what the Bible teaches, and also, frankly, referring to anecdotal information from missionary experiences and a little bit of my own, too. That's this Saturday and Friday night. I'll be Friday in Salinas, Saturday in Santa Cruz, and Joshua is in Salinas. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Joshua. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve.
Hi.
Thank you so much for your ministry, and those comments on Ezekiel were fantastic. My question is on, you were just talking about dispensationalism, but on dispensationalism and Daniel chapter 9, particularly the division of the last week of the 70 weeks.
Yeah.
I wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, this comes up from time to time, and to really give it full treatment, I would need much more time than I have, so I'll just say very briefly where I differ from the dispensationalist.
Okay.
Now, if you want a thorough treatment, which I don't have time for right now before the end of the program, you can, of course, listen to my verse-by-verse lectures on Daniel, which can be found at our website, and they're, of course, free to listen to. But in Daniel 9, verses 24 through 27, there's the prophecy of the 70 weeks. For those who don't know, the weeks really means 77s. And most scholars agree these mean sevens of years. So a week is really 7 years. There's 70 of those, so it's 490 years. Dispensationalists believe that 69 of those sevens transpired, ending at the triumphal entry of Christ to Jerusalem at the end of his ministry. And that at that point, because of the Jews' rejection of him, the 70th seven was postponed and has not begun yet, so that there's been almost 2,000 years between the close of the 69th and the beginning of the 70th of these sevens. All right, that's the dispensational view. They believe that when the church is raptured out of the earth, then the 70th week of Daniel will begin, and that'll be a seven-year tribulation period ending with the second coming of Christ. Now, they believe that in the 70th week, that the Antichrist will set up an image of himself in a rebuilt temple. They believe that at the beginning of the 7 years, Antichrist will make a covenant with Israel, the modern Israel,
mm-hmm.
which will be for 7 years, but he'll break that covenant 3.5 years into it, and he'll put an image of himself in the temple and bring an end to the restored sacrificial system, and then mm-hmm. persecute the Jews and so forth. Now, interestingly, Daniel 9 doesn't mention any of these things. There's no mention of anyone putting an image in the temple. There's no mention of anyone breaking a covenant. There's no, that's not what the passage talks about. It talks about the Messiah coming. And certainly, I believe it's talking about the first coming of the Messiah. And the Messiah, I believe, is the one who confirms the covenant for the last 7 years. And I believe that began at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, perhaps his baptism.
Amen.
And then in the midst of that week, that is 3.5 years later, he brought an end to the sacrificial system by his own death. Jesus died 3.5 years in the middle of the 70th seven. And that was the end of the sacrificial system. The Jews still offered sacrifices, of course, as many pagan religions did. But in, as far as God is concerned, that was the end of the sacrificial system when the Messiah died. And then, of course, the remaining 3.5 years could be seen possibly as the remainder of the time after Christ's crucifixion that God was still dealing entirely with Israel, because the 70 weeks, the 70 weeks are said to be determined upon Daniel's people, Israel. And so after the Messiah died, God still only reached out to Jews for some period of time. But eventually, he converted Saul and officially sent him to the Gentiles. And that would mark the official end of God's dealing entirely or exclusively with Israel. And that we don't know exactly when Paul was converted, but it was something like 3 years or so after the crucifixion. That can be established. So so the 70th week would have begun immediately after the 69th week, and Jesus would have begun his ministry at the beginning of the 70th week and been crucified in the midst of the week and put an end to the sacrificial system. And then the remainder of the week would simply be as the gospel was preached to the Jews only until the time that God called Saul to be an apostle to the Gentiles. So that's a very different thing. The main difference between myself and dispensationalists, of course, then, is I don't see any kind of a gap between the 69th week and the 70th week. The dispensationalist thinks there's an almost 2,000-year gap, but Daniel doesn't mention one, not even hinting, not even a hint about it in Daniel. So since this is the only passage in the Bible that talks about the 70 weeks, it's not even referred to elsewhere in the Scripture, well, it might be alluded to when Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. However, of course, Daniel spoke of the abomination of desolation in two other places besides this, and Jesus didn't say which place he was referring to, but that could be one place where Jesus alludes to the 70 weeks of Daniel. But he did say that his disciples would see it and that it would happen in that generation. So to say that, you know, that there's been some kind of a delay, some kind of a postponement, some kind of a gap between the 69th and 70th week, a very standard dispensational claim, but not found anywhere in Scripture. There's nothing in Daniel that hints at it. And, you know, they often take the he in verse 27. He shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. They say that he is the Antichrist. The only problem
that's
is
the confusion.
The only problem is the Antichrist has not been mentioned anywhere in the passage. Why would anyone be thought expected to think that he is the Antichrist? He is a pronoun. It must have an antecedent noun, and Messiah is the antecedent noun. In verse 26, even verse 25, the previous two verses mention the Messiah repeatedly, and he would be the one that would be referred to as confirming a covenant with many for 1 week. And in the middle of that week, it says he'll bring an end to the sacrifice and offering. That's what he did. So to read an Antichrist into this passage is to import something that is not even hinted at anywhere in the passage. What then causes it to be brought into it? Well, dispensational presuppositions do. But we don't need those. The church got along without dispensational presuppositions for 1,800 years. I think we can get along a little longer without them. Anyway, I'm out of time for today's broadcast. I hope that was helpful to you. My verse-by-verse teachings on Daniel can be found at the website, thenarrowpath.com, along with about 900 other lectures of mine, verse-by-verse through the whole Bible, as well as many topical subjects. They're all free. Nothing costs any money at our website, thenarrowpath.com. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills and keep us on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or you can donate from the website, thenarrowpath.com. God bless you. Let's talk again tomorrow.